Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm glad to welcome back Catherine Stewart, journalist and author, of course, of the Good News Club, the Christian Right Stealth Assault on America's Children, which was actually written in 2012. Now, Catherine was on the show not long ago talking about her new book, The Power Worshippers, but I'm glad to welcome back Catherine Stewart.
Really excited to speak with you again. And, I've been doing this kind of research for over a decade, about a dozen years, and it's very interesting to see how the field has changed in that short amount of time.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things have changed since you wrote that book. Now, I know we talked about it a little bit. We sort of led off with this on the last conversation, but can you briefly kind of walk us through, okay, what led you to encounter the Good News Club personally? Because you're not just a journalist. This actually happened to you personally. And that's sort of, as I understand it, what led you into investigating this whole organization.
That's true. I mean, I didn't go looking for this story. It really came to me, and it started with one of those events that seems so small, you scarcely notice it until suddenly you've fallen down a rabbit hole and you're in a whole new world. So about a dozen years ago, I was living in Santa Barbara with my husband and kids, and our daughter was in a local public elementary school, and I got an email from a mom alerting me to the fact that something called a Good News Club was going to be showing up at our daughter's public school, the Cold Spring School. So the Good News Club is an after-school Bible class aimed at kids in their very first years of learning. They install themselves in public elementary schools, not middle schools, not high schools, elementary schools. Hmm. So when I first heard of the club, I didn't think too much of it. You know, with that first email, you know, the bit about targeting kids in their earliest years of learning, you know, kindergarten, first grade, seemed a little weird, but I took for granted it wasn't a regular part of the school curriculum, and some parents might want this kind of thing. I was a bit naive, perhaps. They described themselves as Bible study from a non-denominational standpoint. I actually thought non-denominational meant non-sectarian. I was so naive at the time. And look, I think you can teach about the Bible, even in public schools, sure, from a truly non-sectarian standpoint, as history or as literature or as a sort of, you know, stories and things like that. But, you know, it soon became clear that Good News Clubs were much more than they appeared to be. And I started to hear stories from other parents in town whose kids were attending schools where clubs had been established. And I started hearing about the kids who were attending the clubs were targeting their classmates for what I could only describe as a faith-based bullying and bigotry. They'd sort of find the only member of a religious or ethnic minority in their class or a child who went to a liberal church, and they'd say, "You're going to go to hell because you don't believe in Jesus." And they would say they knew they were right because, as one little girl put it, "They taught it to me in school and they don't teach things in school that aren't true." Mm. Now, this really got to the heart of the problem with the Good News Club for me. I don't have a problem with kids talking about their religion with their friends at school. My daughter, she and her best friend at the time, were always talking about their different religious backgrounds and religious heritage. But I do have a problem with kids being deceived into thinking that their school favors a particular religion, and then kids being encouraged to use that misleading information to try to convert or bully their peers. So that perception on the part of these kids really isn't an accident. Good News Clubs, by installing themselves in the public schools, they're using the cloak of authority of the school to convert kids as young as five to what's a radically conservative form of Christianity by giving them that false but unavoidable impression that the school endorses a particular form of the Christian faith. So this was kind of the incident that really led me down this area of looking into church and state issues and religion and politics, to be honest. I realized the more I researched this group and the movement behind it, I realized that Good News Clubs were really just one small part of a larger attack on public education. Mm-hmm. And the attack on public ed was one part of a broad attack on our democracy.
It really is. And that's the thing, what I appreciate about the power worshipers is that you talk about how all these Christian right organizations, Christian nationalist organizations, you say it's like an interconnected web of organizations. You see the same people popping up over and over, don't you? And you start hearing the same names and you're like, okay, so that person's on the board of that organization and she's over here and he's speaking over there. And all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute, they're popping up everywhere. And so you have to start putting those pieces together. So I appreciate the work that you've done. It's an exhaustive amount of work.
Thank you. Well, it's really sort of an organization-driven movement. Obviously, there's a collection of leaders, but some people come up and other people fall out. But it's the legal advocacy groups, the policy groups, the data organizations, the sort of media and messaging platforms that are really sort of forming the core of the larger movement. But the attack on public education is a really big part of it. You know, in researching Good News Clubs, I learned a lot about that.
Now, as I was going through the book, I've been listening to it on Audible on the way back and forth to work. It's nice because I have an hour-long drive, so I can really get into it and get a good, you know, portion of the book each way back and forth. It seems to me like as I went through it, there's two kind of theses to the book. On the one hand, you've got the impact of when a Good News Club comes to a local town or an area and they set up shop in a public school and they try to go ahead and have their ministry, and then the impact that it has on the school, the families, and the community. That's one part of it. But then, as you say, the other half is the actual Supreme Court ruling in 2001, which was the Good News Club versus the Milford School. What it seems like it did is it kicked the door open for just all sorts of evangelical, conservative, fundamentalist organizations to use public schools. And as you say, that's opened up a whole can of worms. And of course, the taxpayers, they're footing the bill. We're paying for these organizations, church plants, and all sorts of things in public schools.
That's true. You know, the first part of what you just said is really true. And I think it's important to know what happens when one group, a sectarian group with a very particular agenda going after other people's kids, enters the public school, sort of commandeering a common resource for their, you know, for the purpose of a sectarian agenda and sort of exploiting a publicly funded resource. In our community, I think about what happened to us. You know, the news of the Good News Club arrival really divided the school community in an unprecedented fashion. We had a really sweet school, 200 kids at the foothills of the mountains, and it was just idyllic. Most of the parents were probably Christian. I would say perhaps a third to a half are affiliated with a local evangelical college, Westmont College. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we had Episcopalians and Catholics and United Methodists and Congregationalists and Unitarians. And then we had a few members of religious minority groups, Latter-day Saints, some Jews, a few Muslim families, and some Vedanta, which is a kind of interesting Southern California thing. And, you know, it sort of looks like America, right? So we were nevertheless an incredibly harmonious school and had a large evangelical presence in our parent body. But evangelicalism is also diverse, especially when you're talking about professors or families affiliated with an evangelical college. So we had a lot of progressive evangelicals or moderate evangelicals. But the news of this arrival of this club really divided the school community in an unprecedented fashion. So neighbors started fighting bitterly about the issue, and some were attacked for their faith and ethnicity. It was tragic. A father of two sons who had escaped from part of the world marked by religious wars wrote these impassioned letters to our principal saying he couldn't believe the same thing was happening here in America. How could it be possible that one group comes into the school where no other groups are trying to get in because they know it's quite rude? Like, a mother who belongs to a religion that gets a lot of bad press was really upset and shocked. And she said, if we were doing this, it would be all over the national news. You know, a bunch of the evangelical moms affiliated with Westmont College, they decided that they really needed to put a stop to this. This is not right for our school. So they got together with the Good News Club leaders. They organized a meeting and they said, you know, we are evangelical too. We believe in the Great Commission, but you're just not right for our school. So they actually offered them free and better space in the church, the evangelical church, literally next door to the school, the Monastery of the Covenant Church. It's one of the most beautiful churches in the country. You know, I want to go there after school. It was so beautiful.
Right, it's that cool.
You know, but the Good News Club leaders were adamant you know, their refusal was adamant. They insisted on being in the school because they knew that kids would think their club is endorsed by the school. And they also knew that by placing their clubs in public schools, it would be easier for them to recruit other kids to their club. So they referred to our public school as their mission field and our children as the harvest. Mm-hmm. And this was just, this really sounded an alarm bell for me. So I wrote a piece about this for the Santa Barbara Independent. Nothing had been written about Good News Clubs in public schools that I could find. And I started getting letters from parents all across the country. I mean, it was the Independent was a small region, like local newspaper.
Mm, not a national paper.
Yeah, and somehow, you know, parents found this because they were feeling so isolated in their own communities about what happens to a good, you know, to their school when a Good News Club comes to town. And I heard some horrible stories about how kids were getting subject to faith, you know, in formerly harmonious communities, kids were getting faith-based bullying and bigotry. Hmm. So I went up to Ballard to investigate up there. That's the Seattle neighborhood, I guess. Are you from that region?
I am from Seattle, yep. I'm from East Hill, south of Seattle, the Kent area. So yeah, I've been to Ballard. I used to go to church in the Ballard area when I was an evangelical. So when I heard that section of the book, I was like, oh, I know this area. That's my hometown.
Right. Yeah. So I attended a Good News Club in a Ballard school. And at that school, you know, a lot of the parents were really upset about the arrival of the Good News Club. So some of them met with a pastor whose church was responsible for starting a Good News Club, recruiting adults to staff it. And that meeting just caused pain for them. They really approached him and said, we've got to find a way to make this work. Maybe you can do the club later in the day, or maybe host it at your church or something, or, you know, find some way to make our kids not think it's part of the school day. And then he subsequently wrote on his blog that Jesus carries a sword and sows division. This is somehow a good thing.
I didn't come to bring peace, but a sword. And that's just what happens when you bring the gospel.
Exactly. So the parents met with the principal of the school to try and get him to make the Good News Club at least conform to existing regulations, which all outside groups have to follow. Like, don't promote, you know, the Good News Club leaders were like posting these huge posters in the school in ways that no outside school group is allowed to do. And so there was a guy actually in the community who somehow perceived this as an attack on Christianity itself and apparently had a history of instability. And he wrote some sort of unhinged letters that people found very threatening, and multiple parents actually began to fear for their lives. And some ended up withdrawing their kids from the public schools over this incident. So I came to see that the division that the clubs provoke in public schools aren't really like an unintended consequence of their activity. That division is precisely the point. And it points to the fact, too, that Good News Clubs and the organization behind it are really contemptuous toward public education. It sort of reflects the religious right's longstanding hostility to public ed. I believe it was Reverend Jerry Falwell, who made the agenda clear in 1979. He wrote, "I hope to see the day when there are no more public schools. Churches will have taken them over and Christians will be running them." Good News Clubs are part of a larger war on public education. And again, that war on public ed is part of a general assault on the foundations of modern liberal democracy.
Exactly. Well, you can go even further back than that. I mean, I'm researching and writing a book on the impact of R.J. Rush Dooney on Christian homeschooling. You can go back to 1961. He's writing Intellectual Schizophrenia, which is a withering critique of public statist government schools. So it goes even further back than, you know, Falwell. So these guys have been at it a long time, decades for sure.
Have you discovered his the messianic character of American education?
Yes.
It's a fantastic Rush Dooney book. He says that public schools promote chaos and disintegration into the void, and he claims that they train women to be men. It all sounds kind of funny, but it actually does reflect kind of a longstanding strain of illiberalism that I believe goes back to some of the most painful episodes in our nation's history.
And that's it. You said it exactly right. I think what struck me in reading the book, especially going through the section on the school in my old hometown, was that it's so divisive. You say, okay, it sets school children against school children. Kids are set against the teachers. Kids are against their parents. Parents are against the school for hosting the club. Parents are against other parents. The community is set against itself. I mean, it is so incredibly divisive. And the whole thing is, it's the stealth assault part, isn't it? Because they specifically want to use the public school to create the impression that it's actually an extension of the regular after-school program that's somehow sponsored or connected to the school itself. It's not, they could use the church next door, but no, it's got to be the public school.
And that's absolutely true. So like in Ballard, for instance, the Seattle neighborhood that we were talking about, I went to the club there all after school. You know, some of the clubs are school sponsored, sure, and some of this, them were run by outside groups. But right after school, all the kids gather in the auditorium around different tables where they meet other members of the club and teachers, if there are teachers involved. And so looking at the room, you couldn't tell which clubs were school sponsors and which weren't. I think if you'd asked any of those elementary age kids, which of these clubs are sponsored by the school and which are run by outside groups, they just kind of give you a blank look. They wouldn't know what you're talking about. But here's the thing about the Good News Club. There are a number of adults from the outside, from the church, you know, older people, you know, generally who are affiliated with the church, come in to run the Good News Clubs. They loaded up the table with store-bought cookies, candy, gummy worms, sugary drinks. It was like Halloween on steroids. Mm. And it was like an enormous volume of junk food on this table. And, you know, kids at the other clubs were sort of rubbernecking the Good News Club table as they're walking by, like, I want some candy, you know, stuff my mom doesn't let me eat before dinner. I mean, it was the only one with unlimited amounts of junk food. And, you know, they know very well how to get kids interested in, you know, perhaps joining the club where you can get free candy bars.
Get them hooked in with sugar.
Exactly, hooked in with sugar. I mean, at that age, my kids would have done anything for
absolutely, yeah. My girls would have been
would.
All over that table. So what's the history of the Good News Club? Because as the book goes on, you find out it's not just the Good News Club. There's actually a parent organization, the CEF, the Child Evangelism Fellowship. So what's the relationship between the Good News Club and the CEF? Can you kind of give us a backstory of the history there?
Sure. Good News Clubs are run by the Child Evangelism Fellowship, the parent organization. That group has been around since 1937. It was founded by a man named J. Irwin Overholtzer, I believe, and it is presently based in Warrenton, Missouri. And it's dedicated, the CEF is dedicated to proselytizing kids ages 4 and up. And they have multiple initiatives. They've got groups they call 5-day clubs. They've got groups that target the children of people who are incarcerated. They have groups that sort of do what they call like a kind of mail evangelism, where they establish like pen pals with kids and things like that. But, you know, the CEF was kind of a minor operation for decades, and it really exploded onto the scene in 2001 after this Supreme Court decision called Good News Club versus Milford Central School. And after that, the Good News Clubs went from operating in only a handful of elementary schools to operating in, last I checked, it was something like 6,000 public elementary schools nationwide. The larger organization, Child Evangelism Fellowship, is also operational in about 200 countries around the world.
Wow, that's amazing. And you talk about this thing called the 4 to 14 window. Now that sent chills up my spine, because I can remember when I was in Bible college, we used to have what they call missions week, and they would cancel all classes for a week and you had to go listen to all these missionaries speak. And one of the women years ago, she was from the CEF, and I can remember her talking about this. This would have been probably 1998, 99, somewhere in there. So before the 2001 ruling, but she was saying, you got to get them while they're young, the 4 to 14 window. I can remember her talking about that. You know, children are the best ones to evangelize, the best ones to proselytize. Where did that idea come from?
The strategy of going after kids wasn't something that emerged from the ground up. It started from the top down, actually. And specifically, it started in the Swiss mountaintops about 50 years ago. These high-level evangelical thinkers began to gather at a retreat center called L'Abri. You're probably familiar with it.
Francis
Schaeffer.
Founded
by the writer Francis Schaeffer. Yeah. And it drew in a lot of others who became really important in evangelical circles. They decided to sort of reignite a politically empowered form of evangelicalism, one that would engage the culture and change it. And that became the basis of the Moral Majority, which was led by Jerry Falwell. So one of their key members, this is a sort of roundabout answer, but it's important because a key member of that group at L'Abri was Louise Bush. He's a very high-level strategist in the world of evangelical missions. Like, every business has its own strategists. Like, if you're in the, the airplane industry, there are people who strategize about air travel and things like that. Well, in the world of evangelical missions, there are these mission strategists, right, that think in the big picture. So, you know, the 1040 window, obviously, that area between 10 and 40 north longitude. It was Louise Bush who coined that term, 1040 window. He said that the area evangelical missions should focus their efforts on is between 10 and 40 north longitude. Mm-hmm. And after that, you know, after he sort of identified the 1040 window, thousands of missionary groups were dispatched to those areas in Africa and Asia, and they planted evangelical churches there. So over time, members of the same group decided that instead of looking at those whose cultural and religious identities were fully established, it was important to look at more impressionable targets, and specifically to look at other people's children. So in 2009, Louise Bush came up with another big idea. It's called the 414 window. And the idea is to convert children, focus your efforts on converting children between the ages of 4 and 14. So, you know, Bush's argument here was simple and very effective. He pointed out that 85% of conversion experiences happen to people between those ages of 4 and 14. And he said, when you get them young, you have a better chance of keeping them for life. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, it's imperative we see children and young people as a strategic force that can transform a generation and change the world. I have here in front of me a book called The 414 Window, Raising Up a New Generation to Transform the World by Louise Bush. And it's a really interesting book. It was cited constantly when I was doing my Good News Club research. These different CEF workers and child ministry workers were always referring to this book in the 414 window. In the introduction, Bush writes, "Every major movement in history has grasped the need to target the next generation in order to advance its agenda and secure its legacy in the future. Even the Taliban places great emphasis on recruiting children." And then the end sentence there is, "May God inspire you to join us in his battle for the little ones."
Amazing.
So, yeah, I know. So like you, I came across a lot of missionaries who would cite his research and say things like, if you don't reach kids for Christ early, their beliefs are set for life. Why not put your efforts there now that rather than later at the repair stage? So this is a lot of what the 414 window is about. And I think that's one of the reasons for the focus on children in public school.
So Bush becomes a really key player in that sort of philosophy of ministry or philosophy of evangelism. Because what struck me about it was after this 2001 ruling, then, as you say, that kicks open the door for a whole host of other evangelical ministries to go back into the public schools. We're just going to take a super short break here in my conversation with returning guest Catherine Stewart as we continue to talk about her book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. And really what this is about is ultimately their assault on public schools, which has been going on for decades now. And of course, as we mentioned, it's really ramped up with the 2001 Supreme Court ruling, which has kicked the door open for a whole host of other far-right Christian missional ministries that use public schools for basically free or for very little money. And so this is what's going on, and I'm really appreciative of Catherine's diligent work to uncover what's going on in communities all across America. But before that, I want to give a huge thank you to Michael and Cheryl Nims, who are the latest supporters of this show on Patreon. So thank you to Mike and Cheryl. And for those of you that have been listening to this show for a while, Michael is the voice of the introduction to this show. Him and Cheryl used to live over here in the UK in Birmingham in England. And just before they went over to Canada, which is where they're living now, they came up here to The Rock here in North Wales for a visit. And I got Michael to record that intro to the show. So a huge thank you to Michael and Cheryl for their support. Now, what do you get as a supporter of the show on Patreon? Well, first of all, you get early access to these episodes. They drop on Wednesdays on Patreon as opposed to Fridays. So you get early access to the shows. Also, you get to be part of our closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And it's in those groups that we host our monthly Mindshift Zoom calls. We had last month Kristen Cobes Dume, who wrote the book Jesus and John Wayne. And in fact, if you want to watch that call, I have now posted it to my public Mindshift Podcast Facebook page. So drop in, like the page, and you can view our video chat with Kristen Cobes Dume that we had earlier this month in July. We've also got Julie Ann Smith coming in the month of August. She's going to be our guest on the next upcoming Mindshift Zoom call. We've also got Conway and Siegelman coming in as special guests in August as well. They're working on a research project, and I'm really excited to hear more about what they're doing. So we've got both Julie Ann Smith and Conway and Siegelman. And then, as we talk a little bit at the end of the show about Catherine Stewart is going to be our guest in the month of September. So some absolutely fantastic guests on our monthly Mindshift Zoom calls coming up. And speaking of new episodes too, what's happening in the next few episodes here on the podcast? Well, we have got Dr. Warren Throckmorton. He and I had a great conversation about the so-called historian David Barton. This is a project that Dr. Throckmorton has been working on for literally years, basically debunking a lot of David Barton's fake claims about America's founding as a Christian nation. And in fact, he and Michael Coulter wrote a book debunking David Barton's book, The Jefferson Lies. So we had an absolutely fantastic conversation. I've also had a chat with Dr. Michael McVicker, who wrote the book on R.J. Rush Dooney and Christian Reconstructionism and its impact on American conservatism. This was actually his PhD dissertation, and it's a fantastic book. It's a great history of the life of R.J. Rush Dooney, and we had a great conversation about really the impact of Rush Dooney on so many things. Obviously, Christian homeschooling, the Christian right, and the politicization of evangelicalism, and so much more. So that is a really good conversation coming up with Dr. Michael McVicker. So we've got Warren Throckmorton, Michael McVicker, and I'm also in chats with Paul Kibble, who wrote the book Living in the Shadow of the Cross, Understanding and Resisting the Power and Privilege of Christian Hegemony. This is a fantastic resource, and Paul has done a tremendous amount of work over the years, really revealing what this sort of Christian hegemony is all about, and this is part and parcel of the dominionist sort of culture within evangelicalism that we've been talking about for on many of these shows so far. So look for those episodes coming up. We've got Warren Throckmorton, we've got Michael McVicker, and hopefully in a few weeks here I'll chat with Paul Kibble. So some absolutely fantastic content heading your way. Oh yeah, and I almost forgot, but I want to mention here too, we've got a special bonus episode coming out just a few days after this one drops with David Hayward, the Naked Pastor. I had a conversation with him just the other day about his brand new book that's just come out. It's called Till Doubt Do Us Part: When Changing Beliefs Change Your Marriage. And it's really aimed at those couples who are deconstructing, or maybe one of the persons in the marriage or the relationship is deconstructing, but his or her partner isn't. So what do you do? How do you navigate through that? David offers some fantastic resources. So look for that bonus episode coming up with the Naked Pastor as we talk about his book, Till Doubt Do Us Part. All right, let's get on back into the chat with Catherine Stewart as we continue to explore her excellent book, The Good News Club. Now, I was reading Michael Ferris, who's, of course, the founder of the HSLDA, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, as well as Patrick Henry College. He says, we are sort of the Exodus generation. The people of his age group, they're the ones who, along with guys like Rush Dooney and others, they led the flight out of public schools back in the 70s and 80s. But now, he says, it's the Joshua generation. We've got to raise up a whole new generation of kids to go back in and reclaim the land. So to me, that strikes me, that's dominion theology. That's the whole language around Reconstructionism and dominion theology. Did that strike you at all when you kind of started uncovering all these other organizations doing their thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It did. And it goes back to that 2001 decision, Good News Club versus Milford Central School, which removed any serious establishment clause concerns in connection with Good News style activities. And at the same time, it basically, what they did is they weaponized the free speech clause in order to diminish the power. In fact, I think they've eviscerated the establishment clause. And it basically, as you said, opened the door to outside groups of pretty much any kind. But in practice, it's only really been to sort of right-wing religious groups that have made use of that decision. In my book, The Good News Club, I actually wrote about a couple other groups that were had inserted themselves into public schools, like run by the Kabbalah Center, another sect, and another Scientologist also were running some programs in public schools. But here's the thing. As soon as the religious nature of those programs became known, those groups were kicked out of the schools. I mean, people just found a way to do it. But because the Good News Clubs and right-wing religious groups have these legal advocacy groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom and Liberty Council at their back, they're much harder to get rid of. So it's very interesting. So the Good News Club has basically made use of a Trump card. Their numbers in public schools went up 728% in the 10 years after the Milford decision. Church planting in public schools in New York City, which is a church planting in public schools is another one of these religious initiatives that has made use of that 2001 Supreme Court decision. They went from zero to 160 in the same period. I think that decision, that 2001 decision, is really problematic in my view. So schools routinely exclude partisan political groups from meeting in the school building, for instance, and nobody imagines that we're discriminating against anybody's viewpoint. But now when religious groups are excluded, they complain they're being discriminated against.
That's a classic narrative. Yeah, we're being persecuted.
And even yet, though we're the only ones doing it.
And they've got more access in public schools than they may have ever had in the history of public schooling going back to, I don't know, the 19th century. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet, as you say, that persecution narrative is just, they're right there.
I mean, there are other initiatives, religious initiatives in public schools that have been getting into the schools that are not reliant necessarily on that 2001 Supreme Court decision. I'm thinking about some of the character education programs and so-called Fellowship for Christian Athletes, some of the after-school clubs operating in high schools, which is a kind of different animal in a lot of ways. We can talk about that later if you want. But the Good News Club decision, that sort of, you know, it's an interesting decision. It didn't just come out of nowhere. It's a win that the religious right worked on for about a decade and a half. And what they did is over the years, they put the key sort of building blocks in place in order to achieve a kind of novel reinterpretation of religious activity in public schools. For many years, when they look at religion in public schools, of course, people think naturally of the Establishment Clause. But in this particular case, they wanted a way to sort of reconfigure religion as simply speech from a certain point of view, not religion after all. And therefore, they were able to sort of obtain some protection for their activities under this free speech clause of the First Amendment. So it bears asking, is speech nothing more than, I'm sorry, is religion nothing more than speech from a certain point of view? Is it? Well, not according to our tax code. Religion have tens of billions of dollars every year in unique subsidies and grants and exemptions that other groups simply do not have. Our legal code doesn't treat religion as just speech from a certain point of view. You don't have to, they don't have to open their books to the IRS, whereas a non-religious nonprofit has to open their books. You're going to take public money. You got to show how you're spending it. Religious groups don't have to do that. They have these sort of unique status there. They're allowed to discriminate. A religious group can discriminate on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity, gender. They can do whatever they want precisely because they are a religious group. But this is why they should be kept free and clear of government organizations like Good News Clubs. You can't ask the taxpayer to be subsidizing groups that occupy that kind of unique place in our legal and our sort of tax ecosystem.
Right. And I think it was Jay Sekulow, you mentioned that in the book, that he was one of the very key players going back more than 10 years before, like you say, the 2001 ruling. He went to the Supreme Court, didn't he, and argued for the Jews for Jesus. That was a famous lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court, whether or not they had the legal right to hand out literature in airports in Los Angeles and other places. And off the back of that, they were able to spin that, as you said, keep winning case after case, till ultimately here comes the Good News Club in 2001, and they win, and that just blows the doors open for all these other ministries in addition to them.
It's absolutely true. In fact, when I was doing research for the Good News Club, I went to the National Convention of the Child Evangelism Fellowship in Talladega, Alabama. When you said blow open the door, you know, I heard Matt Staver, who's the co-founder of Liberty Council with his wife, Anita. He said, knock down all doors to all 65,000 public elementary schools in America and take the gospel to this open mission field now. Let's ratchet this up to another level. I mean, there's just a lot of very aggressive language there. I heard a lot of talk amongst Good News Club teachers about blowing open the doors, kicking in the doors to the public schools and just taking, you know, they really constantly, you know, we're going to do the harvest work in the mission fields of the public school children referred to as the harvest. It was
the harvest.
Really, that's quite extraordinary.
So, yeah, that's classical evangelical mission language. I grew up listening to it, hearing it. It's familiar talk to me.
Yeah.
They've got their legal backing. That's the difference. They've got groups like the ADF and ACLJ and some of these other legal powerhouses. They'll represent these groups for free because that storyline seems to come across a lot in your book, that a Good News Club will propose to open up in a certain public school in some town or city. There's a lot of resistance and pushback, but they know they have these pre-prepared letters. Here, give this to the principal. He or she cannot argue. This is strictly legal, and we will fight you. So you're going to have to open your doors to the Good News Club or whatever other ministry wants to use your school free of charge or for very, very little amounts of money. You might have to pay the janitorial fees, but you can't just plant a church anywhere else. You're getting almost a free building. That's what makes it so attractive.
It absolutely does. I mean, these groups, without looking at like the ACLJ, the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Liberty Council, these other groups have combined budgets of over $100 million per year. The ADF's annual revenue alone is, I would say, I don't know, it's $60 or $70 million a year. Yeah. And these groups have basically coalesced to become a key driving force in support of the Christian rights judiciary agenda for America. Mm-hmm. Now, each group has its own strengths and areas of concern. Some of them are interconnected through interlocking board membership, shared sources of funds, shared cases, and a common strategy. And the organizations are staffed by graduates from Jerry Falwell's Liberty University School of Law or Pat Robertson's Regents University of Law and other institutions that are producing tens of thousands of lawyers schooled in a so-called biblical take on jurisprudence and really eager to do pro bono work on behalf of the cause of Christian nationalism. So two of these big groups are the Alliance Defending Freedom, of course, and which was led for years by Alan Sears, and Liberty Council, led by Matt Staver. So each of them published a book. Alan Sears calls it The Homosexual Agenda, Exposing the Principal Threat to Religious Freedom Today. Obviously, they're going after more than gay people, but you know, sort of identifying this as somehow the principal threat. Like, really? I don't know. My husband and I, you know, sometimes we bicker about who's going to do the dishes, but we can't blame any of that on our gay friends. Right. <You know? laughs> And then Matt Staver wrote a book in the same vein called Same-Sex Marriage, Putting Every Household at Risk. I mean, I don't want to speculate about Matt and Anita, but really, does he really feel threatened by same-sex marriage?
Apparently he does. But it undermines the traditional godly family. That's their argument, isn't it? You have to do your homework. When you look at these organizations, what I've found, you have to go into their doctrinal statement. Somewhere they'll have some sort of statement of beliefs, and that's where you start to find, okay, like you say, they're actually a fundamentalist organization with a very literalist view of the Bible, and then eventually they're going to have some statement about, we believe marriage is God ordained between a man and a woman, and there's no such thing as transgender, and so they'll just rule that all right out on their websites. So you can start to find out where these organizations are really coming from theologically. You have to know the language.
Right, and here's the irony. Okay, so they claim to stand up for the integrity of the family, but here they are going after other people's children in their public schools. I mean, they're treating families that don't look like theirs with an unbelievable kind of contempt. And my research, I asked several of the Good News Club leaders or teachers, you know, whether they were very ever concerned about the fact that, you know, the work that they're doing in public schools is leading to division among neighbors, undermining communities, even division within families, and they would just sort of get very defensive and say, well, the Bible tells us we don't have to worry about anything.
Right.
And even the larger point is that the religious right, by allying itself with the far right sort of libertarian wing of the Republican Party, you know, advocating for these far right economic policies that are widening inequality, they're basically promoting policies that make it so much harder for families to succeed. So they call themselves pro-family, but the policies that the larger movement is endorsing is actually dividing families and promoting dissolution of families. Because as we know, all these stressors on families make it harder for them to succeed.
I thought that was a great point that you raised in your book, what you said, that actually, okay, so you get this kid who goes to a good news club in his or her school, and she gets saved, let's say, a dramatic conversion experience as part of this organization, comes home. Now, the parents aren't Christians. They could be Muslims or atheists or Jews or any other religion or non-religious. Now, this kid is trying to proselytize his or her parents, and that is going at it sort of through the back door, as you say, undermining the authority of the parents, which they claim to stand for. So how does that work exactly? Somehow it's okay for them, but not in a Christian home.
Well, I heard from parents who said they sent the kid to a good news club because they just thought, oh, they'll just learn some nice Bible stories and Jonah and the whale or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they come back and they say, Mommy, we're going to go to hell because we didn't go to the right kind of church. In fact, when I went to that national convention of the Child Evangelism Fellowship, I heard people describe, I mean, the contempt for Catholic families was extraordinary. And I can't remember exactly how one of the teachers put it. She was the head of their Catholic ministries. And she said something like, you know, you don't tell them right away that, she says, one thing to remember when you're talking to them, she's talking about the children from Catholic families. She says, don't discredit the Catholic Church, at least not at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So this woman is named Claudia Calderon. She was like the head of their CEF ministry to Hispanic children. And she said, you don't say Catholic Church is bad. Catholic religion is bad. You don't say that to the Catholic people because children go back to their parents and tell them everything that was said. Mm. And what's going to happen? The parent is going to say, you don't go there anymore because you're going against our beliefs. And then she said, you need to remember not to discredit the Virgin Mary and the saints that they believe in. But then during that sort of seminar where we're talking about, you know, they give these special tips for how to reach children from Hispanic families and who are largely Catholic. This one woman was like, oh, it was really terrible. I met a little boy and he said his brother was an angel in heaven. And I had to tell him, no, your brother is not in heaven. Because apparently they're Catholic. I mean, I just thought this is astonishing. You're going to tell a 7-year-old, 6-year-old kid that his brother, who tragically passed, I don't know how, is not in heaven? I mean, I just thought this is...
Unbelievable. Well, I mean, religious trauma.
That's religious trauma.
It is, absolutely is.
The other Good News Club leaders I met disparaged Congregationalists, United Methodists. They called that a New Age church. So I think it's important to remember that I think, you know, most American Christians reject the politics of conquest and division that this movement represents. You know, they will say they are Christians as though there's only one way to be a Christian. That's absolutely not the case.
That's what struck me about it, was the ties to the sort of dominionist vision. Because talking about some of these other ministries, okay, you've got the Good News Club. They can use public schools. And there's obviously a whole host of other child evangelism type of ministries that go in. But then you've got the Bible as literature. These are actual curriculum courses that people can take in public schools, Christian athletics programs, the Athletes in Actions, Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Power Team, those kind of ministries, youth outreach, like you said, YWAM, Peru, Young Life. What really struck me was you talked about what they call peer-to-peer evangelism. That's a whole nother thing. The See You at the Pole movement, the Gideon's Life book, and of course, the church plants in public schools. So it's a vast array of missional evangelical fundamentalist organizations using public schools in America today.
It's true. I mean, regarding these different types of peer evangelism initiatives, I remember one pastor telling me a student can reach their friend for Jesus more effectively than I, as a youth pastor, or even a parent can. Mm. And, you know, the idea is to insert religious programming into the life of the school through peer-to-peer evangelism, and that really only works at, I would say, probably at the high school level. Look, I think at the high school level, after-school groups in general, including religious groups, should have a certain kind of, which should really have maximum leeway. I mean, if a bunch of Christian athletes or Muslim athletes or Hindu athletes want to get together after the game and talk to one another about their religion or engage in acts of worship, that seems perfectly fine to me. Mm-hmm. But as I document in my book, many of the groups are actually trying to make their religion part of the game, and they're inevitably forcing everyone to take a public stand. And what they're often doing is inserting themselves in blatantly unconstitutional ways in the life of the school, even during the school day. I remember giving a talk in Kansas, in Wichita, and hearing from a mother who told me that three boys from the Fellowship for Christian Athletes were leaving religious literature on her son's desk at school every single day. And then every single day, it was like 10 o'clock in the morning, he would just take it and put it in the trash. And they would sort of giggle and, you know, laugh at him and look at this boy. And then they, you know, put it on his desk again. It was basically, this is a form of bullying and bigotry on a par with three boys ganging up in a classroom and calling a child certain words that I'm not going to repeat right here. And the teacher did nothing. So what the mother did is she thought, well, I can, you know, just talk to the boys' Fellowship for Christian Athletes coach. I'm sure he'll understand, you know, he supposedly stands for family values. And he said, she said, you know, this is really, they're sort of harassing my kid. And you should maybe tell them to stop. And you know what he told her? He said, we don't care about you, lady. We're going after your kid, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about that. So, wow. You know, we don't need to get overly legalistic here. Some things are technically, legally, or even constitutionally permissible, but it doesn't mean that they're the right thing to do. You know,
absolutely.
If a school in a diverse setting is supposed to function effectively and function well, its members need to show a certain amount of civility and respect to one another. I mean, we're all free to practice our faith, if any, in our homes, houses of worship, and any number of other places. We really shouldn't be turning public schools into religious battlegrounds.
This is it. Well, as you say, a school becomes a church one day a week. I was thinking one of the other classic examples is, of course, the prayer before the games. That's another one. The football coach or the basketball coach, gather around everybody. We're going to have a prayer before the game starts. And you've got a certain number of players who might be of a different faith or a different religion or atheist or whatever. And when they object to the fact that they have to go along with the prayer led by the coach or one of the players, they are ostracized and bullied in many cases. So that's another example of this sort of religious bigotry that you can see.
That's true. And in many instances, these initiatives, which are supposedly student-led, are actually just, they're like student-led in the same way that like a peewee soccer league is student-led.
Right.
It might be the kids kicking the ball on the field, but the whole thing wouldn't happen without adults orchestrating and paying for the event, providing materials, setting rules and telling kids exactly what to do. So I was in Cleveland, Tennessee, and I decided to go see a See You at the Pole event, which was happening that September morning. So I went to the event at the pole, and supposedly kids gathering around the pole. There were some youth pastors who had previously, like the night before, been telling the kids what to do. They posted a video on YouTube. They had a lot of pastors, youth pastors at their church sort of tell the kids, we're going to do a See You at the Pole event. So they sort of showed up, and some of the teachers showed up and some didn't, of course. And they gathered around the pole and prayed. The kids were leading the prayer. But then after the event, there was like a big event celebrating it at a local megachurch with adults wearing sort of See You at the Pole sort of t-shirts and sort of, you know, hailing, isn't this great that we did this? And, you know, we're really reclaiming our school for Jesus. And, you know, so it's clear the whole event was really orchestrated by adults. But then if they can get the kids to do it, you know, they can say, see, it wasn't us. It was just the kids are doing it. So one of the pastors that was involved in this type of initiative said to me that this was a God-given loophole. He said that this separates, it sort of threads a separation of church and state loophole.
Absolutely. I was doing some reading on the Gideon's website about their life book, and that's exactly the language you're talking about. They're saying, we can't give Bibles away in a lot of places as Gideons, but we can give kids the life book. They can hand it out to their classmates without a single problem. That is 100% legal if the children do it, in air quotes. And yet, like you say, who's printing the life book? Who's funding the whole thing? It's this giant organization, the Gideons, and they're having the kids do their, basically do their bidding, handing out this literature in public schools to their classmates.
That's true. Yeah.
So I have a last couple of questions for you. Maybe we can kind of divert a little bit. Now, we've talked about the Good News Club and then the impact of the ruling in 2001. That opened the door to all these other ministries using public schools. But there's another element to this, and that is the impact of conservative Christians on public school textbooks. So you talk about you went to Texas. Now, why is Texas important? What's the story on they're trying to influence these public school textbooks? Why should they be concerned about that?
Well, Texas was traditionally the largest purchaser of school textbooks. So publishers typically wrote to the Texas standards. This was sort of happening for many years. With the advances in online publishing, it's now easier to customize school books, and the influence of Texas on the overall national picture may be diminishing somewhat. But when I was researching my book, you know, as recently as a few years ago, like when I showed up at the Texas State Board of Education hearings on textbook standards, every single representative of every major textbook publisher was there. It was like a circus. It was actually really fun to watch. I guess maybe fun in a sick way.
Yeah, fun in air quotes again.
So like some people enjoy watching horror movies.
Right, so, can't turn away.
Yeah, I know. And so a sort of far-right faction was dominating the Texas State Board of Education that was in charge of approving different curriculum standards, and they were sort of reviewing the textbook curriculum that was going to be used in, you know, social studies textbooks across the country. Watching that team in action was like watching the death, you know, the murder of education by a thousand paper cuts. Mm-hmm. They implemented all of these small changes that added up to a big shift in the direction of lessons that the children in Texas and beyond were learning about history, economics, race, and religion. All of this was intended to promote an acceptance of far-right economic ideology, a sort of hailing of the free markets, diminishment of the acknowledgement of and respect for ethnic, racial, and religious pluralism. Mm-hmm. The racism embedded in those discussions and the textbook changes that they proved was astonishing and really depressing. And the diminishment of separation of church and state, they're really tying the idea of America to specific religious, racial, and cultural identities.
Mm-hmm. And we know guys like David Barton in Texas, the wall builders, he's very influential on Texas state school books as well. I'm not sure if he still has a hand in that. Has that changed at all? Do you think in the last few years since your book came out, has that sort of changed the dynamic in the Texas school book situation?
I gather that it's not as influential as it was for decades. But at the time that I wrote my book, the Texas standards were like, you know, what everybody was after. So, it was like a three-ring circus.
Last question. We talked about this a little bit. I was thinking as I went through the book that you hear that line, we talked about it before, that the Christians are always saying they're so persecuted. They endured 8 years of bullying under the Obama administration. Of course, now they've got Trump. In fact, I was listening to a guy on YouTube. His name's Rick Wiles, and he's like a complete conspiracy theorist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, you know, right-wing Christian. He was saying the other day that when his order was overridden to call the troops, you know, to tell them to stand down so they could quell these riots. And Rick Wiles was like, that's it. Trump has lost control. The godless communists are in charge. And this ministry is now going to go underground because we're so persecuted. What are you talking about? They've got unprecedented access, but they can point to like the 1962, 1963 Supreme Court rulings, removing public, you know, Bible readings in school, public school prayers. See, they say, that's it. We're so persecuted. What's your feeling now that you've done all this research? Is that a true narrative, or what's the status sort of going forward?
I mean, are they persecuted? Of course they're not persecuted.
That's absolutely
ridiculous. But the persecution narrative is how they build their base. Even talking about those 60 Supreme Court rulings on prayer completely overlooks the fact that for decades before those 62 and 63 rulings, a number of other rulings had sought to affirm the separation of church and state in public schools. I mean, Justice Frankfurter explained, I believe it was in the 40s, in the early 40s, he said something like, any activity that sharpens the consciousness of religious differences among public school kids causes precisely the consequences against which the Constitution was directed when it prohibited the government common to all from becoming embroiled, however innocently, in the destructive religious conflicts of which the history of even this country records some dark pages. Religion in public schools was very divisive, even as early, you know, in the 1840s, when Catholics started to immigrate into America in large numbers. And at that time, public school textbooks were filled with anti-Catholic bigotry. And so Catholic families and priests, of course, didn't want to send Catholic children into the public schools with this kind of nonsense. They were prohibited from reading from their Bible, the Douay Rheims version. And at one point, they really tried to appeal, say, you know, we want to be able to read from our Bible rather than the King James Bible. And Protestant nativists pushed back. And in the 40s, two separate occasions, the streets of Philadelphia erupted and people were killed and maimed in the streets over which version of the Bible would be allowed to be read from in public schools. And similar conflicts erupted in Maine, in Boston, in Cincinnati. And, you know, Ulysses Grant, president at the time, said something like, leave the matter of religion to the altar, the church, the, you know, the home, and leave the public schools, you know, leave religion out of the public schools. The idea was that he said, this is forever, church and state should be separate, because, you know, when you have a pluralistic society, a society is irreducibly pluralistic as ours, the insertion of one particular sectarian group into a common resource is incredibly divisive and destructive.
It really is. I will say that just personally, speaking for myself, what your work has done for me, it's all about this education piece, isn't it? Where you can look at these movements and start to put the pieces together. And I think both of your books, The Good News Club, as well as The Power Worshippers, they do a good job. I've learned a lot from that. It's helped me to put a lot of the pieces together and sort of connect names to faces and movements and things like that, the stuff that I've been researching kind of from the Christian Reconstructionist end. So if people want to learn more about the Christian right stealth assault on America children, they definitely need to pick up your book, The Good News Club. It's an absolutely critical piece of work.
Thank you so much. I mean, you know, we're seeing the fruits of this today with Trump and DeVos trying to take billions from public school while increasing the flow of taxpayer money to private religious schools. And, you know, turning the tap full speed onto the school voucher plan, which is a longtime pet project of the right-wing activists hoping to dismantle public ed and give that money to religious schools. I mean, they're often doing this under the sort of banner of choice, but what they're really trying to do is break the schools. The tactic on the part of many who are behind these types of initiatives is, if you can't own it, break it. And, you know, they may feel that way about our democracy itself.
It's definitely something to be concerned about. And yeah, reading through your book, that will help people, I think, to start. Well, it's about learning the language, isn't it? That's a big part of it, is the key words, the talking points that come up over and over, and the key players in some of these movements. And I think, like I said, that's where you do a really good job of identifying some of the key players, people that we need to look out for. Well, I have one last question for you. How can people find you? What's the best place to get a hold of you, like on social media or in other places?
Thanks so much for asking. I'm on Twitter at Kath S. Stewart. There are two S's there. I have a website, goodnewsclub.me, and usually post my articles there. Sometimes it takes a few days, but they'll go onto my website, katherinestewart.me. I do a lot of writing these days. I've written for the New York Times op-ed. I have something coming out soon in NBC. I had a piece earlier this week come out in the Daily Beast, and I've written also for the Washington Post, the New York Review of Books, the New Republic, and many others.
Right. So people can find your work out there. Do a Google search on Catherine Stewart's stuff. I've read your articles in The Guardian and some other places as well. So yeah, you're definitely out there. So thank you so much. I was going to say too, people can, if they want to come in, we've got you booked for our Mindshift Zoom call in September, I believe. So I am so looking forward to introducing you to some of the people in our groups on Facebook. So thank you so much for agreeing to drop in September as well.
Oh, it's so my pleasure. It's always really great to have a conversation with you, and really looking forward to September as well.
Okay, thank you so much, Catherine. I will speak to you again.
Thanks. Take care.